Supreme Court decided yesterday to toss back to the lower courts a case that called into question the University of Texas Austin's race-conscious admissions policies. This hour, we'll get caught up on the details of that case and discuss what the ruling means for college campuses across the country. Good morning. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 7:07 on Tuesday, June 25th. We invite you to join the conversation this hour as well. How do you feel about the court's decision yesterday? How about race-conscious college admission policies and other affirmative action programs? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Our guest this hour is Laura Schwartz. She's senior counsel and courts matter project director. She served as legal director at the Human Rights Campaign and vice president of external affairs at the American Association of People with Disabilities. Laura Schwartz, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, let's talk about the basics of this court case involving the University of Texas. Could you just get us up to speed on what the court was considering?
The court was considering a challenge to the University of Texas's admission process, which included, as one factor among many for a small number of the applicants, the consideration of race. And the court concluded that although they did not strike down race-conscious admissions programs generally, they did conclude that the court should have looked more searchingly at the particular program in determining whether it's constitutional.
Mm-hmm. And specifically, don't they need to go back and compare it against a 2003 Supreme Court case ruling, Grutter versus Bollinger?
Yeah, the court indicated that under Grutter, which is the prevailing precedent, it's still the ruling precedent, courts needed to apply strict scrutiny. They needed to subject the any race-conscious admissions policies to the most searching scrutiny that is applicable under federal civil rights precedent and 14th Amendment jurisprudence.
Mm-hmm.
But they did not state that either the UT admissions policy nor the other race-conscious policies would be presumptively unconstitutional. They did not overrule Grutter. In fact, a couple of the conservative justices wrote opinions indicating that they thought Grutter should be overturned. The court actually, however, did not do that. And just roughly, the policy in question, I think it's an important aspect of the case. The overwhelming majority, about 90% of applicant of spots at UT are filled by students under the top 10% plan, which affords admission to all students who graduate in the top 10% of a high school in Texas. The remaining spots are determined under a two-part plan that includes both students who meet a basic minimum cut in their grades and test scores, and then also have a subjective piece that includes many things from sports and music to one factor among that being race. Abigail Fisher, the person who challenged this this system, claimed that she was denied access merely because she was white, but in fact many applicants of color with equal or higher stats and grades were rejected, and many of the people with either lower stats and grades who were admitted were white students, the overwhelming number. So there, in the particular case, actually, Ms. Fisher's fact pattern doesn't even establish that she was really injured by the program.
Well, it's ironic then that this case has made it all, as high as the Supreme Court. What accounts for that?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, if you listen to many commentators who support affirmative action, it seems like, you know, the U.S. court system is increasingly looking for a way to reverse Grutter. And, you know, the the Supreme Court had the option to either reject or accept the petition for this case to be heard. The court rejects overwhelmingly over 90% of the petitions for certiorari that come to it, and hears only a very, very narrow swath of opinions. Cases. They don't ordinarily issue an opinion regarding why they agreed to hear a case.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes someone issues a public dissent from the decision not to hear a case, but overwhelmingly we don't know what happened in the court to result in the justices taking up the case at all. Some believe the conservatives want another bite at the apple after Grutter.
Well, how common is it that the Supreme Court tosses back something for further consideration by a lower court?
It's fairly common. What essentially happens is the court is not supposed to engage in a fact-finding process.
Mm.
It determines what the law is and how courts must apply the law, and there are times when it determines that the constitutional question, the court decided a case wrongly. And if they determine that, for instance, if a claimant case was dismissed and the court determines that it was wrongly dismissed, the court doesn't say, oh, you win or you lose. It remands it to the district court to determine to consider the motions to dismiss or the motions for summary judgment in light of the constitutional standard that they articulated. Typically, as court watchers and the American public, we focus in on, the ruling and what the court has said the law is, and oftentimes in really famous cases like Miranda or Gideon, which is the right to representation, it just restarted the litigation process from the beginning, but we don't often look at what happened, for instance, to that individual whose constitutional or statutory question the court looked at. But they don't act as fact-finding judges like a trial court does.
Our guest is Laura. Oh, sorry. What was that?
I said ordinarily.
Okay. Our guest is Laura Schwartz. She's Senior Counsel and Courts Matter Project Director, and we're talking about the Supreme Court decision yesterday to hand back a case, Fisher versus the University of Texas, to a lower court to review it further. The case surrounds the University of Texas's admissions process and its race-conscious admissions process. And we are also going to talk a little bit about the significance, relevance of affirmative action in America this hour, too. Our phone number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And Laura Schwartz, as the university, or rather as the lower courts in Texas get this case back on their docket, what are they going to sit down and start picking apart?
Well, one of the things that the court indicated is that the court should be looking at whether an affirmative action policy, whether a race-conscious policy, would be the only way to accomplish their goals, their legitimate goals of a diverse student body. So they need to be looking at, they'll look at experts, they'll look at the history of Texas's student body makeup, and they'll look at some of the similar evidence that they saw before with an eye to seeing, could Texas have done this some other way? It continues to be good law that that taking race into account in order to establish a diverse class is valid, but they need to look really at whether that's necessary. Was there another way?
Mm-hmm. We should take a break, and I'll be back with some more questions. We have Laura Schwartz on the line. She is she's the Senior Counsel and Courts Matter Project Director. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. in our weather forecast today. A flash flood watch and warnings are in effect through tomorrow and throughout much of southern and western Wisconsin. The National Weather Service issued a flood warning for Crawford, Grant, Vernon, Kenosha, Lafayette, Greene, and Rock counties. Otherwise, we'll have decreasing clouds today with a chance of more rain, highs mainly in the 80s and cooler near the Great Lakes. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope you'll stay tuned after 8 o'clock for On Your Money. June is a popular month for tying the knot, and next hour, Kevin McKinley tells us what money matters we should be sorting out before we get hitched. That's On Your Money coming up after 8 o'clock on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're discussing the Supreme Court case, Fisher versus the University of Texas, which called into question the race-conscious admissions policies of the University of Texas Austin. Our guest is Laura Schwartz, Senior Counsel and Courts Matter Project Director. Laura, we were talking earlier about those admission policies. Could you tell us how their admission policies at Texas compare to other race-conscious admissions policies across the country?
Sure. Well, one of the things that's notable about UT is that the overwhelming bulk of students who are admitted through the so-called top 10% plan. And that law, which has been in existence for a long time, grants admission to all Texas students who graduate in the top 10% of their class. It has the effect of leveling the playing field somewhat for students who are from economically distressed neighborhoods and students of color, because those our high schools are across our nation somewhat segregated by race and class. So by admitting students who have achieved the top level of achievement in their schools, it does increase diversity. So that is a plan that has been on the books in Texas for quite some time, and it is distinct from many other admissions processes across the country. Post-Grutter, no university could determine, could utilize race as more of a primary factor in admissions. There's been a long line of cases that narrow the use of race in university admissions. So you will see across the country race being incorporated into a much more robust set of factors like you see in the University of Texas. One of the big differences, however, is that at UT and in the UT system, really, there's such a small group of students whose applications, are only considered within that framework that includes race. It's because the top 10% plan is overwhelmingly, determines one's admission. Another difference is that the system of that actually incorporates race has various other factors that ultimately bring race down very low in the mix. And again, Texas crafted that after Grutter, as many states did, but they did a very specific system in which they have two so-called indexes, which, again, are not necessarily similar to every other state university. What they do is consider all of the remaining students based on whether they sort of make an academic cut. And those who make that other academic cut are considered based on these more subjective factors. So in Texas, Texas actually did a good job of narrowing down race to a very minor consideration amongst others. So other systems aren't before the court, and I think the really important thing to recognize is that you know, affirmative action in higher education remains the law of the land. What we'll need to see is when the court, you know, when the lower courts take this up again, how strict scrutiny really plays out and how this, no other option idea plays out. So we don't know what would happen, for instance, if another university's program came before the court, except that, or even whether it would accept, you know, the legal standard that a lower court would apply.
Mm-hmm. So
in many ways. Oh, sorry.
Well, on a practical scale, what does the decision yesterday mean for these policies right now? Does anything change at the moment?
Not really. This was such a highly anticipated case, as you know. I mean, Americans have really been following this. Affirmative action and diversity in education is important to many Americans. And so, you know, this case has been building as what many thought, you know, could be a landmark case, and we didn't really want it. But at the end of the day, Grutter is still the law of the land. Programs that consider race, amongst other factors, are still constitutional. And, you know, essentially we have one case before one lower court that's going to continue on. But, you know, universities that have plans that they crafted in light of Grutter, you know, appear to be in no danger of having to go back to the drawing board at all after this case. It ended up being kind of not a disappointing day, a good day, but it mm-hmm. ended up being a day that ultimately doesn't change the way our universities will pursue the goal of diversity.
1-800-642-1234 is our phone number to call if you have a question or comment about this case. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine. We're talking with Lara Schwartz. She's Senior Counsel and Courts Matter Project Director. We have Hugh in Milwaukee on the line. Hi, Hugh.
Hi. The guest talked about the importance of diversity, and, of course, that came up in the 2003 Michigan case, where in 2003 the court, by 5-4 majority, decided that diversity was important. They could use race to give preferences to various groups. And in effect, quotas. Rehnquist, in his dissent in that 2003 case, said, when you talk about a critical mass of minorities, it just turns out that that will be the quota, basically the quota for that state. I think a lot of Americans find this offensive. Diversity, if it's so important, about half the people of the United States are Protestants. The Supreme Court is two-thirds Roman Catholic and one-third Jewish. This does not look like the religious side of America, and yet the Civil Rights Act of 1964 talked about religion in the same way it did about race. You cannot discriminate on a religious ground. And how do you find discrimination according to the EEOC and the commissars that are in power now, the liberals? Yeah, it's by quotas. Well, then surely 1% of America, 2-3% at most, is Jewish. How are they 33% of the court? So the EEOC has never, it's been selective enforcement in the law. They have never enforced the religious side, which is to the detriment of Protestants and others. And the continuing quota system, the affirmative action, is basically anti-white discrimination. It's hiring, promoting, admitting to university, not the best qualified, but the lesser qualified and sometimes the unqualified, and therefore you have a high failure rate of many of the minorities who get this affirmative action boost.
Okay. Thanks, Hugh. And what's your response to that, Lara?
Well, Hugh has brought up several questions, so what I'm going to do is cover each of them as best I can.
And I'll warn you that we have a news break in just 3 minutes, so if we can't get to everything, we'll do that after the news.
Super. Thanks for letting me know. So I'm going to start with appointments to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is appointed per our Constitution. Presidents nominate justices generally from amongst the judges in the land, although some come from other professional backgrounds. Then the U.S. Senate must approve them before they assume their role on the bench. Now, our Constitution also indicates that there is no religious test for holding office. So there is no jurisprudence that would relate to who is appointed to the court and whether their background is Jewish, by way of full disclosure, like my own background, or Catholic, like Justices Alito, Thomas, Scalia, Roberts, but rather by their qualifications. And there's a two-step process established by our Constitution that the President and the Senate, which is an overwhelmingly white male and Protestant body of individuals, will determine whether the nominee is qualified. So there can't be a case regarding whether this is okay, but under our Constitution, you couldn't apply a test to whether a nominee was confirmed if it were so-called justiciable, meaning it could be a case that comes to the court. Now, quotas have been illegal under our Supreme Court's case law for a couple of decades since the Bakke decision. The late Chief Justice Rehnquist characterized the currently legal affirmative action policies as quotas, but however, quotas have been illegal for decades. Rather, what is permissible is considerations of race amongst many. In terms of the question of...
And Laura, I'm going to stop you there, and we'll get to the third question after the news. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Joy Cardine. Our guest is Laura Schwartz, Senior Counsel and Courts Matter Project Director. We're talking about the Supreme Court case on race-conscious admissions policies in the University of Texas. We'll talk more about that after this news from National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio. When Abigail Fisher's college application was denied by the University of Texas in 2008, she decided to sue the college for what she felt was discrimination. She claimed that she was passed over for less qualified minority candidates. In this hour, we're discussing that case, why the Supreme Court decided to toss it back to the lower courts, and the relevance of affirmative action policies today. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 7:36 on Tuesday, June 25th. What do you think about this issue? What questions do you have? Our call-in number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Laura Schwartz, Senior Counsel and Courts Matter Project Director. She's joining us today to talk about this issue. And Laura, just before the news, we had heard from Hugh in Milwaukee. He had made several points, and I think the final one you hadn't gotten to yet was he says that policies along these lines don't admit the best candidates. Can you respond to that?
Sure thing. One of the things that he said was that it resulted in unqualified candidates or being admitted. And that, in fact, is not true, as well as the idea that it does not, our current jurisprudence does not protect white students. When Grudering was decided, companion case Gratz struck down the undergraduate admissions at the University of Michigan. But in terms of qualified students, you know, that is a myth that, unfortunately, opponents of affirmative action have been pushing. It's inaccurate. In fact, Abigail Fisher, refused to tell her full story, but here it is. She was amongst the students who were considered in the second chunk after she did not graduate in the top 10% of her class. She was not one of the top. Amongst the students who were considered in the remaining bunch, her scores were very middling. There were a few students with lower stats than she did who were admitted who were people of color. However, overwhelmingly, the students who were admitted who had slightly higher scores were, in fact, white. So she was rejected in favor of over 100 white applicants who were had lower stats and a much smaller handful of applicants of color. There were also many students of color who had equal or higher stats who were rejected, as well as some white students. So she was not a standout amongst those, and many people who were more qualified than she was were rejected. As well, as I mentioned, the UT policy was particularly careful to ensure that no unqualified candidates were admitted. She was in a group of people who made a cut of a particular level of test score and grades, below which no one would be admitted. So it was, there was a set of people who were considered qualified, amongst whom the state had to choose a small percentage. But none of the people in the pot of applicants amongst which Abigail Fisher found herself were unqualified, and many of those who were rejected, including people of color, were actually more qualified than she was. It's actually a shame that, you know, these litigators have put her through this, you know, public and years-long debate publicly, because it has come to the foreground that this very young woman, who was, you know, in her senior year in high school when this all began, has been in the public spotlight, and it's been, you know, reported in the media time and again that, you know, she was a very middling candidate, which is now public knowledge across our country. It's a real shame for her that she was used that way.
Well, Hugh's point kind of touches on a question I have. When one sees another candidate and that they deem less qualified than themselves, what are they not seeing that the college admissions offices might be seeing?
Well, what they're not seeing is that the college admissions officers in these exceptionally high-quality schools like UT, like U of Michigan, like Harvard, which is a private university not subject to this case law, they are seeing a huge, huge number of applicants relative to the number of spots they have. And what typically, you know, these admissions officers at the top universities will say is, you know, in this group, you know, there'll be a percentage, maybe a third, who are absolutely not qualified and they won't be considered. And there'll be a percentage, maybe 20%, who, you know, are slam dunks. And then the remaining students could all contribute greatly to the student body, and, you know, any one of them might succeed, but they have to have a system of figuring out, well, who would make this well-rounded class? How do we choose from amongst these students? And there are a lot of ways schools do it. People whose relatives attended at school have a much greater chance of getting in. That tends to skew in favor of white, wealthier applicants, people who play a sport, people who play an instrument. And what these admissions departments are doing is taking people who are relatively academically comparable and figuring out a way to build a class that works. From amongst students who all have the power to succeed, the story that Abigail Fisher's attorneys tried to paint was that UT was, you know, sort of digging from the dregs of the barrel to make race the greatest factor. But in fact, admissions officers are looking at a very subtle series of factors, of which race is a very small one. And the individual applicant, you know, it's everything. It's their dreams are banking on those admissions officers seeing them as one of the worthy candidates. But the admissions officers are looking at thousands. And it's really difficult when you're that one person waiting for that envelope to understand, well, you know, a clarinet player would have rounded out the class better than you. But that's what those admissions officers are doing every day, and that's not a perspective that one individual, you know, young person necessarily gets to see.
Mm-hmm. We had talked earlier about how the policies at University of Texas will have to stand up to some scrutiny and essentially prove that in order to achieve their goal of diversity, race needs to be part of the equation. How exactly do they prove that a race-neutral policy wouldn't achieve the same goal?
Well, I mean, that is a question that remains. But one means they could do is look at the history of UT's policies. The University of Texas has been working hard to find a way to do this for many years. They started with the top 10% plan, which has features that many opponents of affirmative action say they really want, which is to give a boost to economically disadvantaged students. It's, you know, throughout the news cycle around this case, opponents of affirmative action have said, look, why would you admit, you know, the son of an African-American surgeon and pass over someone who's really had to overcome enormous challenges due to their socioeconomic class. So UT's top 10% plan should address that. It's somewhat neutral. However, what UT found over the years was that although this plan increased diversity, it really didn't bring the university's student body to a meaningfully diverse level. There were so few students in the school as well as in the individual colleges within UT. So one thing that the university will probably put forth and the court will have to consider is, you know, was UT's longstanding experience trying to use the top 10%, you know, the race-neutral top 10% rule alone and failing to get the diversity that that was their goal, proof that they really had to have a race-neutral policy. And that's certainly what the record indicates. So I think, you know, historically having attempted to do it another way and having that be insufficient is very important evidence.
Mm-hmm. Why did it take 8 months for them to come to this decision if they were just ultimately going to pass it back to a lower court?
Well, you know, the thing about the court is that it's such a black box. You know, the court watchers have been eagerly awaiting these decisions for months, and there are more to come. In the upcoming days, you know, the court still has 6 lit cases left to decide, including voting rights and LGBT equality cases. And, you know, we never know what's going on, you know, what's going to come down. We don't know which of the cases will come down today. And the court has always been like that. You know, they don't tip their hand. It seems clear because this case is so, so narrow and so really, as a general matter, inconsequential, that perhaps a deal was cut. You know, there are justices who wanted to overrule Grutter, and, you know, it's possible that there was a lot of horse trading and jockeying to get votes that took place behind closed doors. You'll note that this was a 7-1 decision, mm-hmm. which, you know, could reflect how uncontroversial and narrow it really is. So it could be that there was, you know, behind the scenes jockeying to craft an opinion that could achieve such broad consensus among the justices, and that can take time. Your listeners might recall that in Brown v. Board of Education, which Justice Warren really wanted to be unanimous, they actually took a second bite at the apple and held it into another term. To get that done. So this, you know, the court has a history of these justices, you know, campaigning within themselves and doing what they can to get the result that they're looking for and issue the opinion they're looking for. And that requires negotiation much of the time. It seems like that took place with Fisher.
Our guest is Laura Schwartz, Senior Counsel and Courts Matter Project Director. We're talking about the Supreme Court case Fisher versus the University of Texas. Abigail Fisher sued the University of Texas Austin when her application was rejected in 2008, and she claims that she was passed over for less qualified minority candidates due to the university's race-conscious admissions policies. So we've been talking about that case. We're going to also put on our thinking caps and talk about what's going to be coming up out of the Supreme Court in the next week or two. Our phone number, though, if you have a question, is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And our email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In our weather forecast today, decreasing clouds, still a chance of more rain with highs mainly in the lower 80s. It'll be cooler near the Great Lakes. Flood watches and warnings are in effect throughout the state today. Until tomorrow, throughout much of southern and western Wisconsin, the National Weather Service issued a flood warning for Crawford, Grant, Vernon, Kenosha, Lafayette, Greene, and Rock counties. You can find more information at our website. We have a weather widget at WPR.org. Right now, we are talking with Lara Schwartz. She's Senior Counsel and Courts Matter Project Director, and we are talking about the Supreme Court case decided yesterday, Fisher versus the University of Texas Austin. But Lara, I wanted to ask you, what cases do you have an eye on right now?
Well, there are a few of the real big cases still to come down. Shelby County v. Holder is a challenge to Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which requires several jurisdictions, mostly those in the South, to pre-clear changes to their voting systems with the Department of Justice or a court, as well as two LGBT rights cases, Windsor the United States, which is a challenge to the so-called Defense of Marriage Act that denies federal benefits and protections to same-sex couples, and Hollingsworth v. Perry, which is a challenge to California's Proposition 8, which bans marriage equality for same-sex couples in that state. The Supreme Court term ends this week. Those cases, as well as a couple more less well-known ones, remain to be issued. The court has scheduled a decision day, 10 o'clock this morning. They'll start releasing opinions. We don't know which of those decisions will come down today. It could be one, could be all, as well as, you know, the Supreme Court could hand down a couple of them and say, okay, well, we're going to do more tomorrow, Thursday, or Friday. It's impossible to know that black box of a court. But there will be, you know, certainly some decisions coming down today.
Do you have any predictions on these rulings?
Well, you know, people say not to, you know, try to read the tea leaves too much. There is some confidence amongst civil rights advocates and people in this country that the court will strike down the Defense of Marriage Act. It seems so clear that discriminating amongst Massachusetts married couples regarding, you know, or excuse me, New York couples, regarding federal benefits like estate tax exemptions, bears no relationship to the so-called preservation of marriage. In the Hollingsworth v. Perry case on Proposition 8, the challenge is that there is a jurisdictional issue, which is whether the people defending the law, and they're not the state, they're just anti-marriage activists, should be in court at all. Do they have so-called constitutional standing to be in court? And the court could very well rule, you know, we can't even decide on the constitutionality of this statute because the litigants can't even be before us. And people think that's a real possibility. The court might conclude that and not get to the merits. They could, though. In the Voting Rights Act case, you know, it's difficult to see. Congress so overwhelmingly reauthorized the Voting Rights Act just in 2006. The idea of a conservative court that has claimed it values deference to legislatures, striking down a law that the Senate approved 97-3 just very recently, it's hard to fathom. And I think court watchers, if the court should strike down Section 5, are going to be really looking at whether this court is just so activist and so results-oriented that they're just not, you know, looking at the facts and doing their job. So, you know, people are intently focused on whether the court would go there, but it does seem inconceivable that they would issue such an incredibly activist decision. And, of course, civil rights advocates are truly hoping they don't, because this is an exceptionally important civil rights statute that has been protecting the right to vote for a few decades now.
1-800-642-1234 is the number to call if you have any questions or comments about some of these cases facing the Supreme Court right now. We have Doug in Madison on the line. Hi, Doug.
Hi. Thank you very much for the conversation. I really just had a very brief comment, and it was back to the affirmative action discussion you were having. I think what's really important from my perspective is for people of a progressive viewpoint to be very careful of the language they use. The bigot who raised the question prior to your break, even when Ms. Schwartz responded, she used the language of qualifications of the individuals. And I think we have to be very explicit that what this Fisher case was about presumably was about grade point average or standardized test scores, where she felt that she had a higher score than an individual. The whole core question here is, what is a person of quality, and what qualifications make somebody justified to have access to the opportunities to enter school or something like that? And I just think it's very important for us to be mindful, because we on the progressive side of the equation are often outmaneuvered by those on the right in the use of language. Thank you.
Your response, Laura?
Oh, I know that was a comment. I think it's important to acknowledge that the case is not about what makes a quality applicant. It's about whether, when a university incorporates race as one small factor in choosing from amongst statistically qualified applicants, that violates the Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution. The factual record does indicate that that there, amongst this group of people, there were more qualified applicants than Ms. Fisher who were admitted. No one contests that she was amongst the group of students who made the statistical cut. And the court, as the United States Supreme Court, doesn't engage in fact-finding. It engages in interpretation of our Constitution and statutes. But I think that the caller makes an outstanding point that, there's a giant media push to characterize this as something that should generate outrage. Oh, my gosh, this young woman was rejected, who was qualified, and unqualified people were admitted because they were Black. And that's completely a false narrative. And when we allow opponents of affirmative action to sell that narrative, we do put ourselves at a disadvantage. Americans of all colors, religions, backgrounds, economic class, don't want to see in this country people losing out on things they've worked for and that they deserve. That is a value that no progressive wants to see, and a value that no conservative wants to see. And yes, when you frame the question as, whether you can ditch a qualified applicant for a less qualified one, that resonates wrongly with the American people, as it should. And we do have to be careful to present this in the light, that is true. The litigants, the challengers to UT's position did not. And it has created a discourse in the media that sounds really troubling to a lot of people. But that's why, at Media Matters, and I encourage people to go to our website, where we have a fair bit of commentary from recent days and beyond about this narrative, to look at that and see how that's, factually inaccurate, and really okay. Something that as well is perpetuated in the media to the detriment of these policies.
Great, Laura. That's Laura Schwartz, Senior Counsel and Courts Matter Project Director. Laura, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Joy Cardine. I want to thank Robin Cherry for producing this hour, Justin Williams for on-air production, and Christy Taylor for on-air direction.